The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, and welcome to a spoiler special about True Detective Season 2, the season that was so incomprehensible it was impossible to distinguish between what was a spoiler and what was just the plot. I'm Willa Paskin, Slate's TV critic, and I'm joined today by Laura Bennett, a senior editor. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Willa.
And Ben Mathis-Lilly, the editor of this latest, and that very rare find, a True Detective apologist. Hi, Ben.
Hi, that's me, yes.
The season was so bad, I think that even here at Slate Pitch headquarters, the only person Slate pitchy enough to like this season was Ben, but that is wonderful news for this spoiler special, because otherwise you'd have just had to listen to Laura and me commiserating about how bad this show was. I want to get to what you liked about the show, Ben, almost immediately. But first, I just want to do a very quick synopsis of what I didn't like, which I think I can sum up as basically bad acting, bad writing, bad plotting, bad mystery. There will be occasion to expound upon all of these things, I think. But just very bad is the emergent consensus opinion on this season, and it is one that I share. Ben, tell me why I am wrong.
Well, I guess, first of all,
that was my best Ira Glass. Did you hear that?
Yeah, that was really good.
It was good.
I think that you're probably, we're probably going to agree on some things. I wouldn't say this is a great season. I didn't think it was as good as the first season. It's probably not something I'm gonna go back and rewatch. But there are a couple areas where I would disagree and say that there were good things, or at least not bad things, about this season. First of all, I liked the characters, and I think I found in writing about the show and why I liked it, this is the one that most people besides me sympathize with. This is where I get the most positive response. I liked spending time with those characters. I was rooting for them in a sense, although I was somewhat appalled by them, which I think is how you're supposed to feel about characters in a show like this. I know you're going to get into this, but I actually liked hearing them talk. I liked the kind of elaborate and eccentric ways that they talk to each other, the dialogue of the show. And I like the actors. I'm curious to hear your specific criticisms of all the actors, because I thought that the four leads, with the exception of Taylor Kitsch, who I don't think was given much to do, I thought the rest of them handled themselves pretty well. The second thing I liked about it, I just liked being there. I think that when I read about this season, I thought, that's a great setting. Like, that's a good idea to set a show in this tiny kind of industrial, corrupt town in Los Angeles or outside Los Angeles. And I think that, you know, the show met my expectations in that regard. Just the actual visuals of it were interesting to me. The kind of what the peripheral characters did, you know, their backstories were interesting to me. And then the third thing, I guess, and it's the most abstract thing and maybe the most kind of personal idiosyncratic one to me, is I just like the atmosphere of True Detective. And I think that what the first season had was great atmosphere combined with a lot of other strengths. And I think this second season might not have had quite so many other strengths, but it still had this feeling of kind of being on the back porch after everyone else has gone to sleep and kind of reflecting and thinking about the past and your mistakes and what might have been. And I like that atmosphere, and I think that most of the scenes that I liked had that element to them. And so while it did have some weaknesses, I think it was every week I didn't have to force myself to watch it just because I knew I was the guy who defended True Detective. I actually looked forward to being there in that world.
Okay, so I think we're going to take your points and go backwards with them, because that was my plan, coincidentally. So I guess we should start by talking about then the atmosphere of the show, which I think we can sort of take more largely to be sort of Nick Pizzolatto, the creator of the show's whole gestalt, which I think includes how he plots shows, what he thinks mysteries are for, what he doesn't think they're for, how the characters talk, you know, and the sort of inherent darkness of his worldview. So I would say I liked that porch analogy, but I feel like when I think about the show, it's someone sitting on the porch, like an alcoholic, drunk out of his mind, just fell off the wagon and just murdered like 12 people, covered in blood, sitting there thinking about how he's abused as a child. Like that, like maybe it's silent for that person. it's not like a cozy, it's not like, oh, or even like in my youth, I had some rough times. I think the thing to me that was sort of the most interesting about this season, not because it worked, but just sort of intellectually, is I think we can all admit that, you know, mystery doesn't necessarily have to be totally coherent for it to be compelling. The Big Sleep is the perfect example of that. The Usual Suspects, you know, really complicated mysteries that you only understand after you understand everything and you go back and resolve it. And also that, you know, mysteries don't unfold like Law and Order episodes where everything comes to the people solving the case in coherent fashion and you can just sit in the room and be like, oh, the most famous guy did it. You know, like that's not how life is. And I think that Pizzolatto made a real effort this season to sort of have the mystery unfold probably in a little more way that it would for real detectives, which is like the guy you met on the movie set that one time that you thought nothing of, like you should have thought more of him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be some kind of compromise with the audience. And Pizzolatto so aggressively didn't compromise with the audience, like so didn't hold our hand in any way that it almost felt aggressive. And then just in the finale, they solve the mystery halfway through. The mystery, I think last season when he was giving interviews about the first season of the show, he doesn't care about mysteries. It was always about these characters and these relationships. So my question is, if he doesn't care about mysteries, why make us do all this horrible work to understand what was going on? Why not just make something pretty coherent and make it about the characters instead of this thing where you have to do all this labor to then get to the characters? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I agree with a lot of that, Willa. I mean, the one thing, I think this season was a terrible season of television that failed on many levels. But one thing, for some reason, I kept watching. And in trying to, you know, have a conversation with myself about why I was continuing to watch the show, I think what it really came down to was the fact that there were these torturous scenes of dialogue that were so let in, not just not propulsive, but like anti-propulsive. And they made you sort of like reel your brain to sort of go back in time. Like, what did I miss that's making me miss what's happening in this scene? But then just when you thought you were going to turn it off, there was some like intelligible set piece that maybe you didn't know who the characters were or sort of, you know, why they were interacting with each other, but you knew what the stakes were. You knew sort of what you wanted from the characters, and that every episode had enough of that kind of thing to sort of keep you going. So it was the guy in the bird mask, and I guess that was the end of the first episode. That's another thing. The episodes are all totally shuffled because the chronology
was not. Right, like the hooker party was kind of interesting.
That was a really good scene, and I think I saw you tweeting about this, Willa, that it was so good in part because there was no dialogue.
Right. Are some of the dialogue scenes that stand out to you as being like totally purple, basically? I mean, I think
so
almost
many.
Every Jordan and Frank interaction had a real special spin, a little purple flavor to
Jordan
it.
Jordan was perhaps the worst character on True Detective.
That's
controversial opinion, but
no, I think that, I mean, she was certainly like has the most thankless part coupled with the most ridiculous lines. I have to confess that my secret like alt fantasy for like the storyline that was going to be revealed in the finale that never happened was somehow Austin Chassani, the mayor, was going to turn out to be Jewish because he at various points had referred to Vince Vaughn's character as boy chick, and he'd also said fakakta. His name is Austin Chassani, by the way. Austin is not the name of any person in the world over the age of 40, and certainly not like an Italian guy, and it's totally preposterous to begin with. But that's also not a Jewish name, and I was like, maybe they like changed the name in Ellis Island to like or more recently, and the whole thing
they
is
changed the first name sometimes. Yeah, real
both
cases.
Of them. And like this whole thing is going to be secretly anti-Semitic because there's all these Hasids with the diamonds, and like there's going to be a whole another world of plot here because it didn't make any sense to me. And also, I feel like so many of the elocutions of the characters had the kind of backwardsness that Yiddish has, where you put the you change your word order.
Theory.
It was because I couldn't believe how it was.
Would there be a payoff really to learning they were all Jewish? Or
no,
was
of course
it just
not. I was imagining like Nick Pizzolatto like spinning out some like this is the secret underbelly of like these guys too, you know, or some other irrelevant character detail. None of that came to pass. Instead, Austin Chassani just said boy chicken but I mean that is like how convoluted I found the language. I was like, I kept thinking that he was trying to do something. And I guess I wonder also, do you guys think that the fact that so much of it felt so leaden or so weird had to do with the actors? Because like, I mean, I know that I think this was stylistically much different than season one, but it's not like Matthew McConaughey didn't have some speeches to give last season.
Right. I think, I mean, this gets to the crucial issue, which is Vince Vaughn bad or good in True Detective? And I think I probably admit the consensus sides toward bad, but I am going to argue that he gave a good performance in part because of that dialogue. And I realize this might not be something that a lot of people agree with, but I enjoyed its kind of like verbosity and confusingness. And I thought that, I mean, to me, it seemed clearly intentional. And I know that there's a specific line that you're going to refer to later about the heart.
Oh, let's just do it. What is it? Blue balls of the heart?
That's right.
I mean, that actually Classic. Line is so perfectly horrible because it's not even elegant in the way some of the other ones were kind of elegant.
Right.
Like, blue balls of the heart is like bro Hallmark.
My reading of the Vince Vaughn character, and I think this is coherent, and it might be too generous, is that he's supposed to be this person who's essentially self-made, right? I mean, well, I think that they really hammer that home, that his dad did not put him on a path to success, let's say. His dad, in fact, locked him in a rat basement.
And made him smash rat.
Right.
Right. Yeah. My interpretation of Vince Vaughn's strange manner of speaking was that he fancied himself this person who was going to rise from poverty to become an impressive person, and that he thinks impressive people talk in a fancy way.
And even I would even give you he had a gangsterese to his style of speaking that presumably he could have picked up from movies and other things. I mean, but this is actually one of those, you know, Pizzolatto obviously has so many influences, but he is so kind of hesitant to share what those influences are overtly. Like, obviously there's references to everything. I don't think he would deny that there's references to everything, but he kind of, in some way, it feels like he wants so much credit that he doesn't make things transparent, where it's like people have grown up watching The Godfather. They want to talk like The Godfather. You have him watching The Godfather. Everyone understands what's happening. And this, he didn't do that. So you're like left to imagine that Frank has concocted this speech pattern all by himself when maybe he's just like aping someone.
And I feel like that, what Ben just said, is a generous characterological reading of Frank.
I've got a lot of those.
My main question was, you know, was it a misuse of Vince Vaughn? Like, there were certain moments that felt like Vince came alive. Like, that scene where he beat up that guy on the side of the road. I don't even remember who the guy he beat up was. That's how, you know, I processed
it,
the plot.
It was not relevant.
No, it was not relevant at all. But
I actually
don't
remember what you're talking
about. And it stuck in my mind because you saw some of the sort of mischief that animated. I mean, obviously, his Swingers is a very different role, but, like, that's Vince Vaughn's best mode. And it's not purely comedic. It's, like, menacing, and there's an edge.
He had a straight-up Swingers line in the finale, right? What was it?
In Swingers?
Yeah, what's his line like?
You're so money and you don't even know it.
He said that in the finale. I missed it.
I don't think he said that.
But he said something very Swingersy, and it was, like, a breath of fresh air in the second that he said it. I actually feel so much sympathy for Vince Vaughn, because I think he was like, I'm going to take this part in this heralded show, and I'm going to show everyone I can act, and director, I feel really insecure about this. Nick Pizzolatto, I feel really worried about this. You're going to make sure that I do a great job. And they were like, totally, never smile, suppress all your personal charisma, say all these lines, and it's going to be great.
Smash a guy in the face with a bottle and have no fun while doing it.
He did exactly what was asked of him, and it kind of stank. And I think that if he had just had a little bit more of his own flair on it, the character would have been much better and great. Like, if he was giving a more of a stereotypical Vince Vaughn performance, I think Frank Semyon would have been a much more appealing character, even with exactly the
similarity of his last name to the word semen is a mystery that we that is not even clear to me.
Perhaps that's the
mystery.
Maybe
it's not a mystery. Maybe it's just totally intentional. I did think, though, for some reason, that Colin Farrell as Ray Velcoro, I thought he came out of this looking pretty good. I think he escaped the True Detective. The new True Detective curse.
The new True Detective curse. I totally agree. I think that was probably, when I say I liked spending time with these characters, I think he's the person that is most specifically true of. I mean, just his face. I mean, he did such a good job of being wounded. Mm-hmm. And it really is, you know, it's kind of a stock character, the wounded tough guy. But he was so unlike, his eyes were so unlike any other wounded tough guy I think I've ever watched, that it was kind of fascinating to see him every episode. And I think the moment that actually hit that home for me was when he and Rachel McAdams' character,
Ani Bezaridis, and Antigone Bezerides. Yep.
Thank God that they did not
to refer to her as Antigone.
Antigone the entire time. That was a blessing. They have a romantic encounter in a cabin, as one does when one's investigating a mystery. And Colin Farrell takes his shirt off, and you can see that he, in real life, is still Colin Farrell, who has like very like defined abs. And you remember, like, oh right, that's an extremely handsome actor who maybe 5 years ago was considered one of like the biggest heartthrobs. So to me, he actually had kind of disappeared into this fat old cokehead piece of crap role. Yeah. And I didn't remember, you know. So I think that's to me is what stands out as someone who gave a great performance.
Do you think they were directed to all speak through, like, as if speaking through a Bane mask, or as Ben has said, a surgical mask? What my dad's one line impression of the show is, I have to go to the bathroom. So that is not a very good impression of the character.
I bet your dad's impression is like marginally better.
It's slightly deeper.
Or as Vince Vaughn's character would put it, we all have to go to the bathroom sometimes.
Right. Yeah. There you go.
The bathroom, we have to go.
It was really strikingly similar, all of the like the rumbliness in all of their voices.
Well, I tweeted this. Yeah. You should never, by the way, I'm breaking a rule. You're never allowed to say what you tweeted in real life. But I tweeted like that that Nick Pizzolatto's like, you know, sop to feminism was he was gonna prove that male vocal fry was really a thing.
Oh, I did see that tweet. That was a good one.
And he really did. And at some point in the finale I was like, if Colin Farrell's voice gets any croakier, will he turn into a frog?
I had that was one moment where like there were certain threads that I was defending as the true detective defender throughout the year, and for halfway through the season I was kind of like, no, this plot isn't too complicated, and then in episode 6 and 7 I had to kind of do this plot is too complicated. Most of the season I was also saying, well, yeah, I can hear what they're saying, you just have to listen pretty closely, and especially in the finale, I had to admit I could not understand sometimes what they were saying.
I want to take like a little bit of a not popular position, which is I actually think Taylor Kitsch was pretty good on this show, too.
I agree.
And I saw, you know, I've seen a lot of people be like, this storyline about him being a closeted cop, like, why doesn't he know it's 2015 and it's all cool and, like, what's the big deal, basically. But I thought that character was totally really compelling. Like, he had, to me, in a way, the most legible emotional journey, like, not a fantastical. I mean, obviously, there was fantastical elements for it. He worked for this Blackwater company. He was, like, a super assassin, basically. But there was something about it that was sort of the most concrete. It was, like, pretty straightforward. Like, he doesn't want anyone to know he's gay. He's gay. He's miserable. He's closeted. He's trying to fake his life. And I thought he actually did a really good job. I was sad that he died because, I mean, this title, True Detective, it means whatever we want it to mean. But, like, I'd seen someone be like, he's sort of, like, in the context of the show, like, the true detective. He's, like, actually, like, a decent dude who's doing this not to try to get custody of his son, not, you know, to, like, find out someone else is corrupt, not for any nefarious reasons, just because it's, like, a good thing to do, and he really just wants to ride his motorcycle and solve crimes.
Something that we can all identify with. Totally. It's a relatable character.
Yeah, I mean, he really bounced back from that end of the first episode, close up on his face on the motorcycle, just like feeling all the pain in the world. I was like, this is going to be rough. But he did. I thought he did a good job. I was sad that he died.
I was also sad that he died. And I hate to jump to this too quickly because I think we're going to get there. But I would compare his nicely legible emotional trajectory with Colin Farrell's also pretty legible emotional trajectory, in that he has this kid and he really wants to be with the kid and he wants to be the kid's father and he's not sure if he is. That I really disliked as a plot because it just felt like another example of Nick Pizzolatto's sort of themes and ideas incarnated. Like, he said in the Vanity Fair profile him, can anyone love adequately? Like, that's what we're getting with, like, this relationship between the son and the father.
Why isn't that an okay question to ask? I feel like that's an entirely reasonable question to ask about all people.
That is a reasonable question, but I just didn't
find it. I think it's actually, it is and it isn't, because I think, honestly, like, most people who are lucky enough to have had, like, a nice childhood, the answer is, like, totally. People can love that. It's like a brain twister that's not, you know? Like,
you maybe can't love perfectly, but adequately seems quite adequately, like an attainable goal.
Sure.
So, yeah, let's talk about the theme. Halfway through the last episode, we basically discover who killed Ben Casper, which was ostensibly the subject of this season, and then there was 45 more minutes of the show to follow our three main characters as they, you know, die and go to Venezuela. So so much of that was also about the subject of parenting, right? Like, Ray basically dies because he wants to say goodbye to his son, and that sort of gets him caught. Ani ends up having a baby, Ray's baby. You know, Frank is walking through the desert, sees his dad.
Could be Frank's baby.
I think it could be, but I think they sort of made it pretty clear.
Right, when they did the baby swap.
When they did the baby swap, yeah, that Ani's
the mom. Always give the baby back to the real mother last. Right. That's a rule of drama.
And also, yeah, I think we have to, like, believe that Jordan really couldn't have kids.
Right.
So, you know, if there was any sort of resonance to this parenting plot that sort of had been, I mean, in Ani's relationship with her own dad, then we found, you know, the fact that Ben Casper was the father of Laura and killed her mother, you know, all of this stuff, did it amount to anything? Like, did you feel like you learned something about the bond, you know? And I think sort of the adoption storyline, some of the stuff that Jordan and Frank were talking about, like, you don't want to adopt a kid because you think it's you, basically.
Right.
Sort of mumbo jumbo. Like, if that actually added up to anything, or...
Well, I think it had the problem that that a lot of the threads had, which is just that you didn't really have time to... I mean, how much do we really know about Annie's relationship with her father?
Right.
I mean, that entire relationship arced in probably three scenes. It really just had a beginning scene, a middle scene, and an ending scene.
I kept expecting more about the good people, and it just never happened.
Yeah, especially when you have, is it David Morse with long hair?
And also that storyline of all of them seemed the most sort of resonant with season one.
Right.
Where you're like, oh, there's like this creepy kind of cult situation. Like, that's really True Detective-y. Let's find out more about that. And he was like, nope, don't. Not this time.
No, I mean, I think that the parenting stuff, except with the exception of Ray, and, you know, and that was kind of like it was a pretty basic plot, you know. I think that's the plot in the fake movie in Arrested Development, which is homeless dad, and he says, I just want my kids back. That was basically Ray's character beat, too. But that at least, like, I mean, I felt a little, like, tug at the heartstrings when the kid had the shield on the picnic table at the end of the, also that was the schoolyard that most looks like a prison yard.
In the history of schoolyards. Like, maybe it was a prison yard.
But yeah, with the others, I mean, you know, you didn't have time to find out much about Annie. You there's this Vince Vaughn thing, you know, you had the rat monologue, and then you had the guy showing up at the end in the hallucination.
This raises two important points. One, gender. We're going to get, we're going to table that.
Good one.
Two, the black guys teasing Vince Vaughn in the desert. What the what, guys? I actually almost feel like that is a Pandora's box that is too hot to touch. Like,
I would not have made that choice if I were Nick Pizzolatto.
I saw that scene and I hoped Ben or Willa will know what that meant, and that it'll have some deep resonance and it won't just
I know what it meant.
Well, it'll mean something other than what it meant.
Okay, well, I think he's from Chicago. He grew up in a tough neighborhood, and unfortunately, the way that was chosen to represent
that
neighborhood was a black neighborhood. And I think that's...
Right, and five black guys teasing him, not even really seriously, is like a core memory for him.
Yeah, I mean,
like a core trauma.
That was another... It was kind of like an unpleasant thing that came up was... Frank is racist and also not super explored until maybe that moment.
Yeah,
but
like he
did make a racially insensitive remark about almost everyone possible.
Totally. He used the word kike. He referred to the Mexicans in all sorts of unpleasant ways. But I think that almost needed to be much more developed if we're going to get this scene at the end.
Yes.
Not that scene at the end would have explained why he's racist, but it's like at this, in the sort of very superficial way that it was explored, that beat was really glaringly bad.
Just also their shoes and their clothing were kind of,
I think
out
it was
of
they were supposed to be 80s. Yeah. Like, it was supposed to be his childhood. Right. So they were supposed to be sort of like Run DMC era gold chain.
Yes, that scene was glaringly bad and I wished it away while watching that final sequence. But overall, I found that last stretch in the desert to be probably one of the most compelling. This might be an unpopular opinion, but I just really liked that final moment when Jordan said to him, oh, honey, or whatever, this is an approximation, you know, you stopped moving a long time ago. And that was really striking.
Well, it's interesting because I thought that scene and then also the Conway Twitty sort of dream sequence at the beginning of episode 3 were some of the more like elegant and certainly artistically fresh moments in the show, and they were so few and far between. Like, you kind of wished he had gotten more surreal more often, maybe.
Totally. And I think that takes us back to something I was going to mention before, which is, if I had to justify the convolutedness of the plot, I would say that it was trying to, like you said, trying to kind of numb you in the way that you might if you were actually investigating a complicated conspiracy that was much too large for you to ever control or solve, you might start to feel kind of numb and overwhelmed. And I think that maybe that he was going for a little of that and went for way, way, way too much of it. Mm-hmm. Because certainly we did come to feel numbed, but not in the meaningful way, just right. in the, like, I don't really want to know more about these mortgage papers or whatever kind of
right.
way. And I think that you're right. If we had had a little less characters 7 through 11 from Vinci and a little more of this kind of with the Kelly Riley character with Ray and his dad,
yeah.
that this season might have been successful for
yeah,
more
I people. Yeah, I mean, it was really remarkable how all of these people that were important to the mystery, like, you didn't know their names.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just didn't, like Holloway. Like, you actually had to look up who Chief Holloway was. That's the guy who Paul met in the dark alley and who Ray met when he was wearing a cowboy hat at the train station to do sort of the trade for the disappeared hard drive.
Right.
Which, again, like, what is the opposite of a deus ex machina? That was the hard drive. Like,
right.
an erasus ex machina. Like, it just, like, didn't, it just, it was like, oh, right, the it doesn't really exist.
Well, that, I think, has a rich, you know, I mean,
yeah.
it's the MacGuffin, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the thing that it turns out to not have any meaning at all.
Yeah.
But it's so true that so many pivotal scenes relied on the sort of pinprick of recognition of seeing someone's face that we just didn't have.
Exactly.
And then the flip side was, like, maybe Pizzolatto was just so aggressively saying, you're not going to know who any of these people
are. Well, I mean,
are.
The other yeah. counterpoint is that it's possible he was spoiled by the attention that was paid to the first season, which, right, like, if
right.
in the first
point.
Season everyone was poring over every detail
right.
so exactly that not everyone but enough people and everyone was so engaged that like the guy that showed up in episode 3 like people knew all about
yeah,
him.
You did know who that guy on the lawnmower was.
Right.
right.
And in this case because it sort of was so hazy and lost us, we didn't know who that guy in episode 3 was.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many scenes that you could just sort of feel Pizzolatto indulging his own kind of lyrical fascination with perverts and freaks that like you're at the sex party and it's I mean that was a really good scene, but
it was a good sex party too.
Yeah, like remember from scene 1 the Yellow King like sorry for this verb but like diddling his disabled. That was another thing. Like, why did that even happen?
I will say, I actually, you said at the beginning that, Ben, that you thought the Vinci setting was, like, very evocative. And I actually think compared to last season, it wasn't. Like, I think it was a really cool idea for a setting that, and this might be the directing thing, that they, like, that Cary Fukunaga, who directed the first season, was not present for the second season, which was directed by a number of different people. I don't think they captured the vibe of the place as well as they could have given how obviously vibey it was.
Yeah, I think that there were certain parts of it that had that kind of flair that you're looking for, like Ray living next to the police station or city
yeah.
hall or what have you. And then obviously like the interstitial shots were, you know, pretty mm-hmm. well composed and kind of cool to look at. But yeah, I mean, I think that the theme that we're coming back to is like a lot of possibly good ideas and maybe just too many ideas.
Yeah.
And I agree with that.
Wait, so let's just go back to gender stuff because I think that among other things, I think you can think about the finale also as kind of response to what happened in season one for a variety of reasons, which Ben included in his piece for Slate.com about why the season was better than people think, basically. But and he pointed out in that piece that as opposed to last season, which some people criticize it for being a sort of an overly sentimental ending where Marty and Russ both lived, everyone basically dies except for Ani in this one. And in this one, the only people who live are the women, and there were no really female characters in the first season at all. But I feel like even as we're talking, it's becoming clear that of all of the fleshed-out main protagonists, Ani was the least fleshed out. Like, we got the least of her backstory. She was sort of, in some ways, the least legible. And so she and Jordan had this kind of ridiculously thankless, you know, gangster mole with more lines part. So I mean, what do you guys think about how he and also some of Ani's lines, I mean, that really like took the stuff on like her, you know, in her sex
yep.
discrimination class mm-hmm. and various other things. Everything's just fucking whatever. You know, there's lots of there's
she
lots,
didn't say
she didn't say that.
Fucking.
She said everything is, you know, there's things other than fucking or whatever. excuse our language. Those are direct quotes from this television show. What did you guys think of her?
Well, one interesting experience I had while editing Ben's piece on the finale, which is terrific and everyone should check it out, is that
Ben gave
her
a lot of insight into my psyche that she maybe did not have before.
And I'm going to cite another tweet, but I'm not going to do it. But you should go read Ben's.
I'm really sorry. I feel like I am that this is something that was between me and Ben, and now it's between us and the podcast listening public. But Ben had a line in his piece about identifying with the characters. Basically, I was like, how? You identify with these characters? To me, they are just like, you know, Pizzolatto quotes with legs. Like, I can't even. And it made me wonder whether there's a different male experience, viewing experience versus female experience. So I wanted to hear, you know, what you guys think about that.
I wanted to just interject and say I'm so excited that you said that. I do want to talk about Ani for a little more of a second. But in sort of talking about the show, and again, now we're going to sort of be sharing personal internal emails among Slate.com employees. Slate.com is a thing that Dan Coy says all the time. It's just
That's
Slate.
Right.
Sorry.
Slate magazine.
Slate. That you've said, Ben, basically, which is like part of what you think some of the critique of the season about is there sort of anything really interesting left in the tortured white male experience? And or are we just so exhausted with that this show is going to get a bum rap no matter what it does? I want to circle back to that. I just want to make sure we're finished talking about gender. And Ani, any thoughts?
Well, I think this could be a segue. I mean, I can say, I can answer the question of why I related to the characters, and perhaps it is for others to judge whether that has to do with gender. I mean, I'm not going to say that the reason I do is because they're men because all men think this way. But, I mean, the way I relate to the characters is not that I've murdered anybody. it's not that I'm a detective or a gangster. But the thing that I think that is, I actually kind of expect to be fairly common was relatable, was that the theme of these people who have kind of messed up their personal lives, and instead of dealing with that, they work on something, which ties back to what does Nick Pizzolatto care about a mystery? Kind of, no, it's these people take a goal, and this is not a new trope in detective or police fiction, but they replace their personal goals with any goal, anything in their work lives, and that for these people happens to be solving a crime. So to them, they're just solving this crime as kind of a distraction, and they become obsessed with it because that they don't want to think about what else is going on in their lives. And I'm not saying I feel that way now, but I feel like I mean, if anyone who has ever been sad or depressed or felt bad about anything probably has tried to distract themselves by working. And I think that is a part of it that is pretty relatable. And I don't think that's a particularly male feeling.
It's interesting because the words that you say make sense to me. But I cannot say that I feel related to any of those characters. Like, I think that that's right, what you're saying. But something about how it was presented, that's not what... It didn't come through to me almost that it was like they were getting through with the work, because also they were all, I mean, Ray was a bad cop. He didn't care about, I mean, he sort of found this redemption by finally caring about his work. I mean, I think at the end someone's like, we never knew you were this competent, you know?
That was a funny line. That was funny thing in True Detective. That's the one thing I'm going to stick to, is that there were many funny lines.
I think there were
season.
Actually way more funny lines than we got to hear, because they were presented as not funny
lines.
I think if you read the script, you'd be like, oh, that's a funny line that they made not funny. And I think that's a direction issue.
Right.
But, you know, it's interesting because when I have to confess that when I think about things that I identify with, I mean, I really loved the first season of True Detective, so it doesn't necessarily have to have a woman in it, but it certainly doesn't hurt, you know?
Yeah.
And actually, I love it when there's love stories. Like, I'm such a sucker for that. And so, like, the fact that Ani and Ray got together, like, should usually have been like, great. I actually like Nick Pizzolatto's dedication to love, Russ and what was Marty's wife's name? Michelle Monaghan's character,
right.
I forgot about. You know, not that there was a love story, but like I thrill to those sorts of things. But I thought that them getting together in this was like take it or leave it. Like I didn't really care very much. I think that in this one, he wanted to sort of not to make up for it personally, like to prove himself above sort of criticism about the female character thing. And I don't think he's super great at writing women.
No.
And it's like a reason he should have a writer's room, for lots of reasons. Like, he should have a writer's room because they would have helped him sort out this plot stuff. And they would have, you know, streamlined some stuff for him and given Ani some lines that, like, she could have plausibly said.
Right. And nothing about Annie like registered as particularly sort of female to me. She talked in the same way as the other characters. She's the same sort of anxieties and hang-ups as the other characters. I didn't think the Velcoro-Bezerides coupling arose from any kind of interesting tension, just like desperation. And it didn't. I thought she was just as likely to end up with, I mean...
It's interesting, you know, in the beginning where she had that... Not the beginning, but in one of the early conversations she had with Velcoro, where she's like, you have... Imagine what it would be like to be a person walking around every day and any man could just murder you. I mean, I'm paraphrasing badly, but, like, could you... Like, the anxiety, not just of being a cop, but just of being a woman, where you can constantly just be murdered.
Which is why you guys both carry knives. Large knives.
I mean, I have
at all times.
Seven
it's
on me right now.
In my holster right now.
And, like, I feel like, in a way... So that's not untrue, but I feel like Pizzolatto was like, aha, I have unlocked the key to the female psyche. This is my way in. And I have unlocked, like, especially a cop. And, like, it's not even that that's not, like, a interesting thought or a entry point, but it's not, like, the only one. And it's like he could only get in on this way of violence. Like, that's the only way he
And with a backstory of abuse, he had to sort of hand her that. And then
but
just,
I think he has his own history with abuse, so that is actually, like, connecting him personally to her. But, like,
interesting.
It's like he was I think he was making a good faith effort, but there's just like some he doesn't there's something wrong there. Like he doesn't quite understand how to write women and he's not going to get it.
Yeah, I mean you talked about the ending. You have the two women surviving and kind of and being in that last scene being active in a way that I think it was really fortunate that the last act was not just to leave the men to die, which is this terrible kind of trope of women in these kind of movies. No, you have to go.
Right.
Like, I'm the man who can take the punishment. Showing that Rachel McAdams and Kelly Reilly were kind of conspiring to bring down the Vinci mob from
and
afar.
Rescue their men's reputations.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was fortunate that he did that.
Yeah, and I actually have to say... The scene of them, like, in their sun hats at night, I was like, cool movie to be. Like, I would watch that, but of course, like, he wouldn't. It was like, oh, this is when it turns into Thelma and Louise.
But, right, and so he hadn't really set that up in, you know, episodes 2 through 6, you know, and that's the problem with this, you know, is that you didn't know much about them besides that you learned very late in the season that Rachel McAdams had been abused, and then... Or at least you saw more about it.
No, it's true. We didn't really learn it for sure until the party
scene. The hallucination, yeah.
So just to, like, wrap it up, I think, what do you guys want? What do you expect? What do you hope for? What do you fear about True Detective Season 3?
Well, I mean, I was trying to think about the difference between Season 1 and Season 2 and why I enjoyed Season 1 so much more. And I think fundamentally it was just the tension between Marty's sort of standard-issue sinner trying to be good and Rust's brooding nihilism, sort of believing in nothing. Those two bumping up against each other, that's what made, like, the car scenes feel sort of emotionally or psychologically claustrophobic rather than just dramatically airless. Like, there was comedy in that tension. It was also, they were really good actors and they had a nice rapport themselves. But somehow having all of these main characters with sort of roughly equivalent temperaments and worldviews just kind of like fractured the whole, like the tension wasn't the same, dynamic wasn't as interesting. And so I sort of think just at a very basic level, limiting the number of main characters and sort of putting them in opposition to each other in some way would be more interesting.
I'd like it to be set in the Yukon.
That's not bad.
I mean, it's good work. I mean, it has to be somewhere where the overhead shots will be exciting. Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with that. And I think that having, like, someone who can deliver the comedy a little more, that will provide some tension relief to the discussions, which is, you know, I enjoyed all these kind of, like, really morose conversations, but I totally agree. I mean, my favorite moment from Season 1 is when they're meeting with the woman who had worked for the bad guys. The woman who had worked a long time ago as like a housekeeper or something for the bad guys starts rambling about Carcosa.
In Season 1. Season 1.
And they come outside and her I think younger daughter apologizes and says, I don't know what she was talking about. And Matthew McConaughey says, oh, I understood exactly what she was talking about. And the woman, the younger woman, looks at him and just says, that should worry you, mister. And that was the kind of line that was missing.
Although, in my recollection of that scene, that also, like, wasn't really played for laughs.
I laughed.
I think, you know, it's interesting. I think that this season, and Nick Pizzolatto said this in the Vanity Fair profile, the only thing that connected this season and last season was his sensibility. And all due respect to his sensibility, we could use, like, some more connective tissue. And I think, in addition to it being a mystery, in addition to it probably being about fewer detectives, in addition to maybe it having more play through time, I think that was a really interesting part of season one. And I think he sort of tried to have some of it in this season because we sort of have this back history about Ray's wife's rapist, but it really ends up just playing out in the present. I think, like, he should lean into some of that weird, creepy, surreal stuff.
Totally.
Like, the occult history of transportation, which is what supposedly the season was about. Dude, I still am interested in the occult history of transportation, and I wish that this had been more of that. And I think it's cool to lean into the conspiracy stuff. And I think it also lends itself to the kind of fanaticism of viewer, like the viewer fanaticism that was in season one. Is like, if you want to give us a real mystery, like, for people just to go crazy over, like, make it super weird and creepy and have all this, like, culty, strange stuff. And there was, like, hints of it in this, but he didn't really do it. And
he really just teased us with that bird head.
Totally.
Right. Yeah. That was weird bird head.
Yeah, and he teased us with a bird head, with a cult, with, like, all this stuff.
I mean, this is the guy, that's the thing that's so strange about watching these shows, is that he is really good on the occult, on the surreal, and then as he, I think this was also in the Vanity Fair profile, that's sort of our text here, is that he read the 1,000-page-long practical homicide investigation textbook, and that's what made this, like, gave new meaning to the word procedural. There's, like, so much procedure here. Yeah. Limit that, like, amp up the
more
the
weird,
mystery.
Wacky stuff.
Right.
So, lighter, cheerier.
More occult, more humor.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the Yukon.
Totally. And good luck to all of the actors who take this part on. We will be holding you to the McConaughey standard. You should probably run. I think that's it from us on season two of True Detective.
It's all that needs to be said.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Slate Spoiler Specials. This episode was produced by Jason DeLeon. Joel Meyer is our managing producer, and our executive producer is Andy Bowers. Thanks a lot for listening.